from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. We've got a bit of a literary show today. I'll talk with author Ken Beckley about his inaugural novel, Knuckleball.
I'll chat with author Jonathan Jans about his book, House of Skin.
And then we'll shift gears as I get a preview of the Ensemble Music Society's new season. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Ken Beckley is a familiar face and voice in Indianapolis. He spent time in television news, served as H.H. Gregg's executive vice president, and has been president and CEO of IU's Alumni Association. Now he's adding a new title, novelist. Sharon Gamble invited Ken to our studios to talk about his first novel, Knuckleball.
Standing on the pitcher's mound on a hot, humid Sunday afternoon in August 1955, I couldn't have imagined what would happen to me over the next 35 years. Focusing intently on the catcher's mitt, I bit the inside of my right cheek to keep from grinning when I saw my favorite sign, three fingers pointing toward the dusty clay ground, knuckleball. Digging the tips of the middle three fingers of my right hand into the height of the baseball, I went into my windup and threw, the ball traveling with no rotation whatsoever and dipping suddenly just as it reached home plate. The batter stood frozen, the bat never ever leaving his shoulder. Strike three, shouted the umpire, game's over. With that, I, Davy Miller, had tossed my third no-hitter of the season, a summer in which I painfully learned life can be like a knuckleball, unpredictable, and sometimes the bottom drops out.
Well, I have to ask you, I know this is a work of fiction. Can you throw a knuckleball?
I can, and I did.
Yes. Do you remember the moment in your life when that metaphor actually did hit you? I'm sorry, it's a simile, like a knuckleball. It's a simile.
Well, not really. I played baseball and I threw a knuckleball, and but I never had, fortunately, the knuckleballs of life thrown at me that my character Davy did.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, there's tragedy in this book, and while I have been around death involving family members and friends, no tragedies quite like I describe in my book.
Thankfully.
Yes, thankfully is true.
The Davy, though, is it strikes me he's somewhat like you, or at least like the public image that you portray, in that he bounces back. He loses his father very young in a really awful, awful way.
Yes, yes.
His father is killed in a mining accident. What tempted you to write a novel?
I wanted to write a novel because I had written all my adult life, all my careers, from fact. I was a journalist. I was in public relations and marketing. And so everything I wrote, news stories, news releases later on, advertising copy and brochures, all of that was based upon fact. And I wanted to prove to myself, number one, that I could write fiction. Always been a reader of novels, and so I just learned a lot that way. And then I got some great advice from my favorite Hoosier author, James Alexander Tom.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me some wonderful advice as I prepared for writing the novel. And so I just wanted to do that. And then I wanted to...
Wait, what was the advice?
Oh, well, the advice was, and it's very interesting. I went to James Tom's home, which is near Bloomington. He is married to, or was, I assume he still is, to a wonderful lady, Dark Rain, and they hosted me at their home. And I said, may I have 30 minutes with you? And I ended up staying over 2 hours, as I recall, and she even fixed lunch. But he said, from this moment forward, I want you to observe every way in which people express themselves.
Wow.
Verbally and with their bodies, their foreheads, their eyes, their heads, the bobbing and so forth of their heads, their hands, their gestures, their shoulders lifting up and down, their chest, maybe their size and so forth. He said, because you are going to have to, number one, adequately develop your characters so that people really do understand they are real people.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's fiction, they're real people.
Sure.
They can identify with them. And the way they express themselves verbally, everybody's got their own idiosyncrasies, if you will. And so be prepared to do that. And that, his advice, which I then followed for probably about a decade, made lots of notes over those 10 years after I would talk to people. And some would, some were a little more interesting to me than the others in the way they expressed themselves. But I would make notes of that, and then that really helped me in developing my characters in the book.
Now, did you intentionally limit your cast of characters, if you will, your palette, and say, okay, I've studied enough 40-something women or 10-year-old girls or whatever, I need to move on? Or did you just observe everyone in case any one of those types might come in handy?
I observed everyone, from people where I grew up in southwestern Indiana to people who lived in, let's say, more sophisticated areas like New York City.
Sure.
And so because I didn't know exactly where I was going with my characters.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is that when I started my book, which I had in mind for 20 years, I knew what the beginning was going to be. I knew what the ending was going to be, but probably at least 75% of the middle of the book, I had no idea what it was going to be, and it just bugged me for years. So when I sat down to write the book on April the 1st, 2009, I still did not know what the middle was going to be.
And I
didn't know who, so therefore I didn't know who all the characters would become.
It's like saying, I live here, I want to end up in St. Augustine, Florida, but I don't have a map.
Exactly. I didn't know how I was going to get from A to C.
So did you end up in the process of writing, did you start outlining, or did you just wake up and see where the characters took you every day?
I outline the beginning and the ending,
and
I develop my major characters on paper. And then our mind is so amazing. If you give it the freedom that it needs, at least to write creatively, my mind just took me. People who read the book, I think that having heard me say this, they will just be amazed at how it all ties together, in my opinion, of course, as the author, but how it ties together so very, very well and is entertaining at the same
time.
Sure.
Well, and it's quite a feat to, you know, those of us who love to read, and most of our listeners do, it's such a magical thing to get drawn into the world of a novel or a short story and to just go along for the ride and to believe the narrator, whether it's third person or first person narrator. And we often don't remember at what cost the author gained our belief and imbued that narrator with the credibility. So I believe Davy is remembering his pesky older sister and the time when he accidentally walked in on her and she was brushing her hair but didn't have anything on.
Yes.
You know, you believe that moment. But more importantly, I believe that Davy's mom got promoted to vice president during the Great Depression at a moment when, She had no idea how she was going to keep a roof over her family's head, all the way up through Davy's job adventures, through friends coming back from Vietnam. So I'm guessing there was a fair amount of research on your part, either that or it's truly an autobiographical piece and you do remember all this, and I don't think that's true.
It is not true, no. It starts out with some experiences that I drew on that I actually had myself or that I was aware of as a child mm-hmm. or as a young person. But then it takes on a life of its own. I mean, the entire book is a life of its own. But I really did want, and thank you for bringing that up about Davy and his sister, I wanted people to be able to identify with these characters, that these are real people. I mean, they felt they were very, very mm-hmm. real people. The readers felt that. And I hope that people agree. And based upon the dozens of reviews that I've received from people who have read it, they do believe that this book just not only ties a story together so well, but they just love the characters that I invented.
Well, and I can't imagine anyone who can't relate to the idea of life throwing a knuckleball in your path. Things are going smoothly, and all of a sudden, didn't see that pothole there that I stepped into and broke my ankle, or something much worse. How did you know what to leave out? Did you end up writing lots more pages than ended up in the novel? Or did you have some characters knock on your door and did you say, okay, you're going to be in the next book?
My editors took care of some of that. Interestingly, I wrote this book in third person and submitted my manuscript in third person. I fully expected, being a first-time author, that the editors would just rip it apart. They'd say, this is terrible, this section's terrible, rewrite it, mm-hmm. don't like this, you don't develop this enough, you don't develop your characters enough, and so forth. The editor who first got the book had it for about 5 or 6 weeks, and it came back to me, and it threw me a curveball, a major curveball.
Really?
The editor asked that I change it to first person. I was not prepared for that at all.
And he or she explained why?
That they felt that it would be much more believable and much more interesting if done in first person. Well, I did not agree at all, but I decided, now wait a second, Beckley. This is your first book. This is a professional editor who makes his or her living
sure.
doing this. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to change it to first person, which took me 2 months.
I was going to say it's a way bigger challenge than just using the search and replace function in a word processing
yes,
program.
Well, yes, all the references to him and to them now
sure.
became I or mine and ours and so forth.
Was there anything that was too intimate when you changed it to first person?
Yes. You're very perceptive. Yes, I had described from a third-person standpoint some torrid love scenes that took place between Davy's mother and his father.
Mm-hmm.
But once changed to first person, obviously he could not have known about those unless
sure.
his mother told him, which she didn't. And so that had to come out. So I originally submitted my manuscript at roughly 152,000 words, and by changing it to first person, I had to remove about 17,000.
Wow.
And so there are a number of scenes that are now sitting in a file in my computer that would have been in the book. And there were some other areas that I thought were interesting in the book, where Davy, as an example, does some leadership training
mm-hmm.
To the Automobile Dealers Association of Greater Evansville. And the editor felt that had no place in this particular novel. And so I finally agreed with that and pulled that out. Maybe that will be in my next novel.
I was just going to say, so what's next in your fictional journey?
I'm so inspired by the reaction to this that I do want to write another novel. And I have a germ of an idea. It is going to take far more research than this one did, because a lot of this I knew of incidents that took place that I described in this book.
Sure.
I knew of them, although I made them fictional. I mean, for example, when Davey goes to a particular baseball camp, I knew all about things like that.
Mm-hmm.
This book that I am thinking of writing, I don't know. Well, it's just going to require a huge amount of research. This particular book, Knuckleball, I wrote every day for 2 years, from 4 to 5 hours every morning without fail, even on trips. So I would set the coffee pot at night, the timer,
mm-hmm.
get up at 6. By 6:30, I was writing. I'm a morning thinker.
Mm-hmm.
I think with my fingertips, you know, at a computer keyboard. And I wrote until 10:30 or 11 every day.
Did you ever have a day when things weren't flowing and you just found yourself writing the same sentence over and over, or tearing it apart? And,
oh,
really?
I was
You're
so lucky. I never had writer's block.
An on-command muse.
Yes, yes. I was so fortunate. And I allowed myself 5 years to write the book, and it took to the day 2 years. So I'm very, very lucky.
So you're going to be back in here way sooner than we thought you would with your new book.
We'll see. I don't know. It's going to take a great deal of research. And when I said I wrote every day, I
sure.
wrote and researched.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And thank God for the internet, because I believe that having that at my fingertips probably saved me a year of trips to a library,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Sharon Gamble with Ken Beckley. Learn more about Ken and Knuckleball at kenbeckley.com. That's KenBeckley.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Okay, a gothic horror novel may seem a bit out of place during the middle of the summer, but author Jonathan Janz thinks that any time of year is perfect for a little scare. Travis DiNicola spoke with him about his new book, House of Skin.
Jonathan, welcome back to Art of the Matter.
Thanks so much for having me back here, Travis. It feels great to be here again.
You are very welcome. So I'm thinking about a year and a half ago you were on, just had a sort of a gothic horror novella coming out at that point. Now you've got a couple books out, another one on the way. Things have been going well for you.
I really attribute all that to you. I think that was your influence. You know, otherwise I'd be totally unpublished.
Well, of course,
then,
well,
but, shortly after we had our interview,
you're not the first author to say that. But thanks.
You definitely got that Midas touch. After we had our first interview, my first novel was accepted by Don DiOria,
mm-hmm.
who was he's a pretty legendary editor. He was the guy who was the mastermind behind Leisure Horror, and that was really the biggest horror imprint in the world for 20, 25 years. But when that company went under during the recession and everything, he ended up kind of a free agent,
mm-hmm.
and he ended up at this company called Samhain.
Okay.
And Samhain Publishing, they're located in Cincinnati, and they're a great publisher. They really predominantly do romance, but they
So horror is kind of new for them.
It is new.
I mean,
new.
Some people make call romance horror, but anyway.
Of that kind of is. But they were doing so well in romance that they wanted to branch out into a new genre, and when Don came open, he knew the head of the company, and it kind of became a natural fit, and so they decided to start with horror, with Don at the helm, and shortly after he got that job, he acquired my first book.
And that was The Sorrows?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the new one that is just coming out is House of Skin.
That's right, yep.
Great titles.
Thank you.
Especially love the title House of Skin. These are kind of old school gothic horror books. I mean, I think of like some of the movies like, you know, House on the Hill or Gothic. I mean, it seems like there are these castles or mansions that, you know, people end up for whatever reason they're staying in or visiting, and they're definitely haunted in
Absolutely.
Some way or another. I mean, that's kind of a Is that a fair description?
Oh, I think so. Okay. Yeah, it really harkens back to the Hammer horror of the 60s and that kind of film. I really I like intimate horror.
Yeah.
I'm not a guy who probably will destroy the world with a plague or with a horde of zombies. I mean, I love reading that stuff, but I don't think I'd be very good at writing it. So I really like kind of cozy horror. It's a strange, cozy mystery, but I like horror set in an isolated region with a relatively small cast of characters.
Sure.
And I think that way you can really have some frightening scenarios play out, and The Sorrows both and House of Skin fall into that category with just the kind of settings you described.
So tell me a bit about the basic plots for both of them. Let's start with The Sorrows, because that one's with a castle, right, in California?
That's right. It's a mythical island off the coast of California called The Sorrows, and on that island is a castle called Castle Blackwood. And essentially that has, as you would imagine, like every castle does in every book, has a bloody history. And the two main characters are composers. They're film composers, and they're scoring a big-budget horror movie for the most demanding director in film. And
this is contemporary?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It is. Now, what I love about the Gothic structure is you have your contemporary story, but you also have that backstory that has some antiquity.
Right.
Exactly. And so the other story runs from 1911 to 1925.
Nice.
But there's a contemporary story that's, interspersed.
Okay.
And essentially the problem they run into is that the creative half of the duo, Ben, his wife has just left him for another man and taken their three-year-old son. So his entire life has been shattered.
Wow, yeah.
And the deadline is looming, and he can't think of anything else but his broken family. So to unblock him, the arranger of the music, his friend Eddie, decides to rent for a month this purportedly haunted island and this castle to try to inspire him to write music for a horror movie. So they go there with two women, and that's, of course, where everything goes terribly wrong.
You know, I've always had this idea that it'd be really fun to create a book that actually had sound effects built into it.
Yes.
You know, like whether it be like a rim shot or whatever it would be, and there'd be like an asterisk where it tells you to open it up at the end. I mean, kids' books, some have sound effects, but imagining, as you're writing The Sorrows, you had to think there were times where you wanted to have that music in the background for people as they were reading it.
It's so funny that you mentioned that. You probably are familiar with Goodreads, the reading website. Well, it has a ton of reviews on there, a ton of ads on there. It's done really well there. And one of the most recent ones is that's the gist of the review.
Really?
This lady gave me a 3-star out of 5 review, which is fine. It's slightly lower than the average, but her review was very positive. And she said if ever a book would benefit or would logically marry to, an audio or multimedia format,
soundtrack,
this is the one that would do it.
Huh.
Because she said that the book feels like it should have a score
as
they're trying to write their music. Yeah.
So what were you listening to when you were writing this?
I tell you, the stuff that inspires me the most, I love movie music, as you would imagine from the subject matter of that book. I love Bernard Herrmann's Psycho score, Vertigo, but even more so, I love Baroque music. Bach, Vivaldi, I love that kind of stuff because it's attention-getting enough to kind of stir my imagination, but it's not distracting to where I can't think of anything but the music. So it's really the perfect marriage of those two dynamics for me. And I listen to
Very
it every
cool.
time I write, yeah.
Very fun. Now, House of Skin, a little bit different story. This one's set in a mansion with basically a body that won't go away.
Yeah, there's a it's part of a tradition, all kinds of subgenres in horror, and one of the lesser subgenres is this fearsome woman who is kind of ageless. She's eternal, and she comes back, is reincarnated through different generations, and always wreaks havoc, always brings about
destruction. I was thinking a little bit like of Rebecca or something.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, Rebecca would be part of that tradition.
Yeah.
Daphne du Maurier. I think that my favorite one is Ghost Story by Peter Straub.
Oh, sure, of course.
And that's my favorite horror novel, and really that's probably the primary inspiration for this. And I'm very, very proud proud of that connection. But anyway, Annabelle is the woman in this particular book who comes back generation after generation. And her new victim is a guy named Paul, who's just inherited the mansion. And of course, he's inherited much more than he thought he did.
Right.
Thinks he's lucked into a gold mine, but she's waiting in the woods. In fact, there is a brief prologue, probably the briefest in history. It just says, "She waited." And it's, just to kind of remind us there is something lurking in the forest, in the ground.
I kind of just got chills when you said that.
Well, good. Yeah, I hope the book does that.
That's very fun. So now something really cool that I heard about with House of Skin is if you are in New York City this summer or through the fall and you look up at Times Square, there's actually from Samhain, the publisher, right, an ad that's running in Times Square that one of the things it does is feature the cover of House of Skin.
That's right. Yes.
And that's kind of awesome.
It really is awesome. It's exciting. I need to send somebody there at some point to, you know, reconnoitre that and to take a picture of that because I want to see it. But yeah, according to the publicist there at Samhain, they're including House of Skin. It really is a beautiful cover, just beautifully gothic. And there's this woman who's kind of blindfolded, but it's not twisted. It's just a little bit dark and creepy, but elegant as well. Mm-hmm. And that's one of about three or four covers. I think Ramsey Campbell, who's like the British Stephen King, his cover is another one that's going to be on there. And yeah, once a day, it's a 15-second spot, and mine will be one of the ones featured all the way through the end of the year. Yeah, it's really exciting.
That's pretty fantastic. So what's next for you?
Well, I got an agent about mm-hmm. a month ago. I had an agent before, and that was a long time ago, probably before I was ready to get an agent.
Yeah.
My writing wasn't there yet. I'm not saying it's arrived, but it's better than it was 3 or 4 years ago. And so I got an agent, and she's this wonderful woman named Louise Fury, which I think is a cool name.
It's a great name.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Does she have an eye patch?
She should. She really should. Actually, one of her other clients is Fabio, the model. And who knew that Fabio wrote romance novels?
Right, right.
I had no idea. So he can star on the cover and be. But anyway, she helped sell my third book, which will be coming out in 2013. It's called The Darkest Lullaby. Okay. And it's kind of, I see it as kind of a combination of Rosemary's Baby and The Shining. It's got that kind of that vibe to it, or those two vibes combined. I'm not saying it's as good, but it's definitely inspired by those two. And that'll come out in early 2013 from Samhain as well.
Okay, so what's the scariest movie you've seen lately?
Ah, good question. Wow, let me think a little bit here.
One that really, like, just rocked you when you saw it.
Yeah. I tell you, I'm watching one now that's not a traditional horror movie, but it's pretty disturbing. It's Shutter Island.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying it. I'm behind the times. You know, now that we have kids, we see everything like 3 years after everybody else does. But I think that's been effective. I saw
got a real gothic element to
it. It really does. Oh, yeah. That's what I loved about it. I love the isolated setting on the island. Mm-hmm. I love the backstory, the history of the island and DiCaprio. I love that. We're actually not done with it, but we're about halfway through and I'm loving it. Another one I saw that's really not scary but very funny is Tucker and Dale versus Evil. Don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't
seen that.
It's
kind of a comedic horror movie. And it's really effective, really good. Yeah. One I want to see is Sinister with Ethan Hawke. It's coming out here in a month or two, so that'll be good. And then the next one on my queue is Paranormal Activity 2. Again, I'm behind the times.
Yeah.
Haven't seen two
those
or three,
fun.
But those are the ones next I'm going to see.
So, I mean, is it ever? I know that you're a dad, and you know, recently we just had Father's Day, so happy Father's Day
Thank
to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Chad.
And you know, you've got you know, a young child at
home.
Yeah. Is that kind of weird sometimes? I mean, you know, watching her and then writing these horror things.
Well, what's funny? Yeah, that's right. I have a 1-year-old daughter, and I have a 4-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old son. And it's funny.
Okay.
We must have a good marriage, my wife and I, because the biggest point of contention is the number of books we have in our house. And really, the location of the books has been the biggest cause of strife, because my bookcases were located in my daughter's new nursery. We moved her into this beautiful, it's got pink and white and light green, and there are these dark bookcases filled with horror novels, right, with vampires and werewolves and zombies. So that's actually what we've done for the past week is we got everything painted, we got everything moved to another room, so now I'm quarantined. I love how
I just love the idea of picturing the nursery with all these horrific books on the
shelves. That's exactly what it was. It's everything was beautiful, butterflies and then horror, this little pocket of darkness. And my kids are great. I think I shield them, and you know, most of the time my son inevitably will ask me to tell him a scary story.
Sure.
My son and daughter were talking the other night. I guess I shouldn't say his name, but he was talking to his sister, and she was saying, tell me a story. He said, okay. And she said, but not scary, because I guess his stories are always scary. And he thought for a moment, and he says, okay. This one's called The Day Before Death.
That's not the scary one.
Not the scary one, right?
Right.
That's the sweet little one with unicorns, apparently, for him. So I think it's rubbing off to a degree.
Just a little bit.
Yeah, I'd love it if we had a Stephen King, Joe Hill situation one of these days.
That'd be fantastic. Well, hey, Jonathan, a real pleasure to chat chat with you again, and congratulations on your success. It's great that you've got these two new books out, as well as a third on the way, and keep scaring people.
I will. Travis, I think it's just one thing about you that I appreciate. You always make me feel so welcome, and you had me on here before I really had anything published at all. I had a couple little things, and you had me on here, and you treated me like I was some important author, and not that I'm an important author now, but I really appreciate that you're uniformly kind to your guests, no matter their level of success or lack of success.
I just don't want to be like killed off in one of your books.
that's the real motive, huh?
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with author Jonathan Jans. His new novel is titled House of Skin. You can get more information at jonathanjans.com, JonathanJans.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You know what's coming up just around the corner?
Just around the corner? Is it that Independence
Day? It's Independence Day, and I know a lot of people are taking advantage of it being in the middle of the week and mm-hmm. maybe taking some vacation
mm-hmm.
before or after, and maybe they need to mix it up a little bit and go out and do some fun things that we have on our calendar we call
What do we do?
Do you have suggestions?
Well, you know, I think a great thing to do is to get out to Symphony on the Prairie. I mean, this Ooh. Weekend there is the music of Queen, which is going to be just a ton of fun with, mm-hmm. you know, of course, Bohemian Rhapsody and Killer Queen and Fat Bottom Girls, all those great songs. but then coming up on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, the Star Spangled Symphony on Prairie, 8 p.m. every night with the ISO performing all sorts of very patriotic music. So grab your blankets and your picnic basket and go out there for the 1812 Overture, accompanied by live artillery, as well as Stars and Stripes Forever and a whole bunch of other fun stuff out at Connor Prairie. And of course, there are fireworks every night. This is a great way to celebrate the 4th of July.
Excellent, excellent. The Sisters of St. Benedict in Ferdinand, Indiana, are putting on a summer social on Saturday, July 7th, from 11 till 9, 11 in the morning till 9 at night. And they'll have more than 35 booths of food and fun, country store, art show, over 40 handmade quilts, a money wheel. I'm not even sure what a money wheel is. Do you know what a money wheel is?
You spin it and win, I'm guessing.
It sounds like it. Musical
mm-hmm.
entertainment,
spin
kids,
and
fun and games, bingo, grand raffle, guided tours of the monastery church, and that's really the reason to go, and so much more. They're going to have chicken dinners, barbecue, brats, hamburgers, hot dogs, pork chops, walking tacos, baked goods, and lots more. And I've had some of their home-baked goods. The Sisters of St. Benedict know how to bake. So
I've never seen a taco walk. But anyway.
Well, you can go to the summer social on Saturday, July 7th and see one of those. thedome.org/social is where to get more information. And again, that's in Ferdinand, Indiana, a short drive away. thedome.org/social.
I've got some other ideas for some road trips for the coming week. You might want to go up to Angola, where they're having Angola Balloons Aloft, July 6th and 7th.
Ooh.
It's a very alluring name. And they're having lots of balloon pilots up there competing for cash and prizes, filling the sky with their brightly colored airships. And there'll be lots of other entertainment
that
and remote
so control quaint.
Planes and food and children's fun fair. Should be very fun up in Angola. Check out Angola Balloons, AngolaBalloonsAloft.com. There we go for more information.
You're full of hot air.
Oh.
Hey, on Friday, July 6th, next Friday, this coming Friday, one of the great classic Katharine Hepburn films, Bringing Up Baby, directed by Howard Hawks, 1938. Fabulous, charming, sort of romantic comedy, very light fare. Where can you see it? On the grounds of the IMA.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, so you can take your picnic dinner out and... your lawn chair and so on and so forth. Films start around dark. In other words, what is that, about 9:30?
Yeah,
so bringing up baby on July 6th.
Here's another road trip for you. The Madison Regatta, July 6th through the 8th. If you were looking for excuse, maybe you don't need one, but to visit this lovely town of Madison on the Ohio River, well, their regatta is taking place. It's a hydroplane boat race with the world's fastest boats. It's also known as the Indiana Governor's Cup, and it's very, very cool. In fact, this race, are you ready for this, Sharon? Features top boaters who are vying to star in the next James Bond film.
Ooh.
Okay, they're actually kidding about that, but it's still a really cool idea. That's part of their promotion.
Darn, I was all excited.
MadisonRegatta.com for more information. Very fun, though.
Wow, I was so excited.
Yeah, it still sounds cool, though. It could be.
It could be. If you're interested in genealogy, listen up. Next month, a two-day conference is coming up. It's put on by the Indiana Historical Society. It's called Midwestern Roots 2012. Where do you think you find it? It's at
in the Midwest.
In the Midwest, that's right. It's at the Marriott East, and there are some pre-conference activities on July 19th, and the conference itself is July 20th and 21st. All sorts of great speakers, more than 30 thought-provoking lectures from nationally renowned speakers in the fields of genealogy and family research. There's also a family history market and a book fair, so lots of cool, cool stuff going on at Midwestern Roots 2012. Find out more at indianahistory.org/Midwestern Roots.
Very good. For you dancers out there, the Indiana Ballet Conservatory is having a contemporary masterclass in ballet with Carlos Dos Santos Jr. He's a faculty member of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. He's also a world-renowned choreographer and dancer, and he is going to be in town on Saturday, July 7th. He's going to be doing 2 1.5-hour contemporary masterclasses for kids 9 through 12. And then also another one for 13 to 18. And it just sounds great. You can go as a student or go to observe. If you want to get more information, go to IndianaBalletConservatory.org. Great opportunity.
Speaking of ballet, here's a save the date note. This is an event you love every year, Travis. It's Indianapolis City Ballet's Evening with the Stars. It's Saturday, September 8th. So that's going to be a big day. Put that on your calendar. That's also the day of the Penrod Arts Fair. So that's coming up September 8th.
And tickets are on sale now.
That's great.
Evening with the Stars. I can't wait for that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sharon.
Have we run out of time already?
I hope you have a tremendous July 4th. Enjoy your holiday.
You as well. Be very safe, though.
Yes. Be careful of those fireworks, especially when the grass is dry. So we will be back next week with more things for that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Everything old is new again in the Ensemble Music Society's 2012-2013 season. Sharon Gamble learned about the esteemed chamber music presenter's season from its president, John Faley.
So it strikes me that some of the usual suspects, not so much in terms of performers, but in terms of composers, are represented this year. Some of the tent poles, as they're sometimes called, the most beloved works. Is that true?
Well, I think that is true, Sharon. Now, while we don't yet have the repertoire for the opening concert in our 69th season, the Kallikstein-Laredo Robinson Trio, we don't have their program selections yet, but you know, in and amongst all of the, the Beethoven and Haydn that we often see on our series, we're going to actually have an Indianapolis premiere performance of our on our series of a Franz Schubert string quartet. So that's
Now, wait a minute. How is that possible?
Somehow, in all these years, we've missed his final quartet, the number 15 in G major, and we're excited about having it. It's a big work, and maybe that's why it's not performed so often, you know, as the more well-known Death and the Maiden and all. But it's a wonderful work with the terrific melodies we all associate with Schubert. But we also are going to have a number of, you know, newer works on the program that I think will be very interesting to people who, you know, might think they only like Beethoven, but we've got quite a season planned.
What are some examples of those newer works? That's that, and I have to say that that adds a great deal of spice to this this upcoming season. The prospect of, for all of our ears who love and revere those great chamber works of the repertoire, it's great to be able to hear new works.
Well, you mentioned the usual suspects of composers, of artists and composers. Like, you know, Beethoven and Brahms and all, but some returning artists to our series besides the Kallikstein Laredo Robinson Trio is the St. Lawrence String Quartet. They've been a favorite of our audience for a number of, you know, previous visits, and they're going to be doing a program for string and clarinet that will include not only the well-known Mozart clarinet quintet, but also a contemporary work by Osvaldo Galeoff called Dreams and Prayers of Isaac the Blind. And Isaac the Blind was a Renaissance period, mystic rabbi that is really, this piece I think will just be a jaw dropper. It's just so powerful a work and communicates, a spirituality that I think is going to be a real hit with people, you know, if they can, you know, bring themselves out of their seat after such a, you know, dramatic performance. It's I've listened to recordings of it, and it's really a wonderful piece.
And it calls for string quartet and klezmer clarinet, right?
Actually, more than one clarinet in that work, and the klezmer tradition of Jewish clarinet playing is a unique expression of that instrument, and so a Gentile clarinetist with a name like Todd Palmer, who was raised a Methodist, you know, Galeoff himself wondered whether or not he, you know, had the feel for it, but he was converted. He realized that Todd is a tremendous artist and really liked his performance, so.
Music,
when the composer approves, that's great.
There you go. And music is non-sectarian. It's a universal language. You can be of any persuasion and figure out how to play.
That's right.
Things of other cultures. Yeah. Renaissance motet transcriptions, music by Gesualdo.
In and amongst the five concerts, we have three ensembles coming to the series that are new to us. This will be their first Indianapolis appearance. The Kuss Quartet from Germany, the Pavel Haas Quartet from the Czech Republic, and the third new artist on our series is Jack Quartet. And they, I think, are the most exciting presenter of new music on the scene today. They're going to be performing at a concert at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and this is our third year partnering with the Indianapolis Museum of Art on a concert focused on contemporary music. And you might say, well, what does Renaissance music like Gesualdo have to do with contemporary music?
Sure.
And I think that those who know early music will see that it pushes the boundaries of tonality in a sense that is very different from what those of us who listen to you know the classical and romantic period are used to. It's going to be a concert that's sort of is new in both directions, both in moving back in time as well as to have works. The rest of the program is going to be all works by 20th century or contemporary composers, and I think it's going to be very exciting.
There's some great harmonies in Renaissance music that to our modern ears probably sound kind of modern. Some dissonance, some experimentation, although you don't. It's hard to remember that people experimented 3, 4, 5 centuries ago, just as they continue to do today.
And Gesualdo has such an interesting, you know, history of this dark side of when he, you know, murdered the lover of his wife, and when he caught them in an affair, and never had any retribution because, well, he was a Renaissance Italian prince. But it's it all makes for a great story. And certainly if you go to southern Italy, you know, you'll learn more about that.
Before we leave the Jack Quartet, none of them is actually named Jack. Do we know the story of their name? Just sounded fun. It's a quartet. Jack
it
has four letters.
Fun. The members of the quartet, their first names are John, Ari, Chris, and Kevin.
Oh, there we go.
So that's where they got it. But they got the idea from some other quartet that used some initials to spell out a word.
Sure.
And before. But so when they didn't know what to call themselves, they just called themselves Jack, and then it stuck.
Perfect. Love it. Take us behind the scenes, because 69 seasons, which you have not been there for but a handful of, mind you, you're still a young man, but is there somewhere in your office a master file? Did you have some student intern at some point create an enormous spreadsheet of all the works that have ever been performed courtesy of the Ensemble Music Society, or is that something in the works for the 70th season?
We have a large three-ring binder that goes all the way back to the beginning in 1944, and that was published in a booklet that we gave to our subscribers for our 50th anniversary, but we have not updated that for recent things. But we keep very careful track of all the works that have been performed, and so that's how I knew with some confidence that we'd never had this, you know, Schubert G major quartet before.
What a treasure that you have all those materials. Somebody's been a
careful really is.
Archivist.
It really is.
I have this impression, and I don't know if it's true or not, so help me out here, that Ensemble Music Society might have been created in part to, as a little bit of a peacemaking idea, to bring international quartets, you know, since the series was created basically almost at the end of World War II. Is there any merit in my supposition there?
That's a good observation, Sharon. The series was started in 1944, and at the time when people saw the end of World War II, you know, as something that was probably going to happen very soon, and wanting to start thinking about how to return to life as it used to be, the music leaders in Indianapolis also saw that there were a lot of musicians who had come to this country from the turmoil of World War II, and were looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
And so to present series like this gave work to those musicians. Larger cities, you know, on the East Coast, where most of these artists came to from Europe, you know, would provide either commissions of symphonic works. I know that's how Bela Bartok managed to make ends meet, you know, toward the end of his life after coming to this country, but the performers also needed work, and so they were starting to tour, and transportation was a little easier then. There were not as many, you know, restrictions on travel by 1944 as there were earlier in the war, and so it was a good time to start something like this.
Mm-hmm. What's your observation? Again, you've been a board member for is it 20,
long time.
20 years now?
At least, yes.
And you're, in public at least, you call yourself a non-musician. You do play. You're a pianist.
I'm a pianist, but yeah, I just as a serious amateur,
yeah.
I'd say.
Yeah, well, there's a place in the world for that. What drew you to put up your hand and say, I'll help out, I'll be on the board, and then ultimately I'll be the president of this organization?
Well, I think this concert series is you know such a treasure for Indianapolis, and you know I think to have concerts like this in a venue like the Indiana History Center is also you know a great treat that everyone who appreciates classical music that wants to you know expand their knowledge of music beyond the, you know, the classical top 40 that you see on iTunes or Amazon.com. But, you know, if you go to the Indiana History Center, you know, I'll put in a plug here even for series that are doing programs similar to ours, organizations like the Laureate Series of the International Violin Competition, the Indianapolis Early Music Festival, and the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, to just name a few. The Basile Theater at the Glick Indiana History Center is our home base, and while there's you know several other good auditoriums that we all use from time to time, that's such a you know a treasure to have that theater for concerts like ours. The sound quality is exceptional. It's got beautiful architecture and free parking and handicap accessibility, and it's just, you know, unmatched anywhere in central Indiana for a small concert experience.
Great sight lines, too.
You can
really see the musicians communicating. It's one of the things I love about it.
And that's the real key. Every time I've been to concerts like ours with chamber music artists, and I've been to, you know, concerts all over the U.S. Hearing these kinds of groups, and anytime they're in a really large hall, you know, an orchestra type hall, it's just not the same kind of first-rate experience that we try to provide to our audience.
Sharon Gamble with John Faley. Find out more about Jack Isaac the Blind and tickets to the Ensemble Music Society 2012-2013 season at ensemblemusic.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4, when, for the Independence Day weekend, we'll revisit some of our favorite interviews from earlier this year.
I've got a preview of the upcoming Broadway Across America season.
I'll get my motor running with a look at the Steel Ponies exhibit at the Idle Jar.
And then I'll chat with author Dan Barden about his new novel. Plus, there'll be our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.